It's very well written, this article. Under capitalism, everything corporations do is to make money, and that's it. The result is a proliferation of jobs that are socially useless as they are demanding, and billions of people around the world performing those jobs with no input or sense of connection to the work itself. And that's also a contradictory thing I find in all the different jobs I've had and stuff. Workers will try to make the best of it. They'll say, oh, I like my job. I like doing this. I like doing that. You know? And then you talk to them maybe a week later, and they're like, I hate this. I hate that. You know, and it's all this stuff about their job. They hate their boss. They hate it, with good reason. But they're taught to be positive about it. You know, and it's hard to be around people that are complaining all the time in a kind of personalized way. You know, what we need is a class complaint. We need to be like, yeah, as a group, being able to say, this sucks. We know it sucks. No illusions. Here's how we can change it. Boom. You know, that takes a movement. That takes a political party. That takes unions. That takes a lot of different stuff to get to that point. Because everyone wants to like see it through their own little bubble, you know. But there are times where, again, that's contradictory too. Like, I know somebody that's having trouble where I work, and they ask me, is this how it's done with other people? In other words, this person has a supervisor that's picking on them in a way that I can truthfully say no. Around here, where the union has been strong in the past, or our type of union has been strong in the past, they're not, they haven't really done what they're doing to you. So this is really new and odd, and you should continue to fight it. We should help you, and blah, 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 you know.
Socialist. Why, they're trying to get him out the door?
They're trying to get this person to, they rejected vacation time. There is a little clause in the contract, unfortunately. Again, weak union leadership, stupid union leadership, actually, at Harvard in the Clerical Workers Union. But they have a clause where management can deny you vacation time. But in the place where, where I work, the departments where I work, that's a very rare thing. There's no objective reason for it. We're not like emergency workers or something, and even then, it's something you'd have to negotiate. We're understaffed and so on, but no, they don't. They don't pull that. They don't say no. You can't have vacation time. Because if you have it, if you've earned it, right, through the formula that you earn vacation time, which is could be a lot better too. But anyway, then this person though, all of a sudden, they're like, no. You can't take that on those days. Sorry. So that's just completely wrong and unusual. So if you took that to an arbitrator, eventually you might lose. The union leadership probably won't back this person ultimately because of that, although they're in tentative discussions about it. But if you had a healthy union that could put pressure on management saying, no, past practice here says we get that time. There's no reason, there's no logical reason that you can think of for her, this person having to be there, blah, blah, blah. It should be a no-brainer. It should be an easy win. Yeah. The union, the management should be afraid.
Get well-staffed so you could cover all your, you know, and everybody gets there, you know.
See, what's so insidious about this idea of being partners with management and, you know, joint unionism and all that is it's a form of business unionism, which basically redefines unions not as voluntary associations of workers, but defines them as part of a corporate structure. And that doesn't have to be the case. There's unions where, like the building, even now, the building trades unions, they're not affiliated to one company. They don't work for one company. They work for different companies. So there's a light, so that you can go to the union hall, you can get hired one company X one day, company Y the next day, right? Your loyalty is not to the company. Your loyalty is to the union. There are other unions that they get so ingrained in the idea of they're representing people, but only at this job, only at this workplace, or these people only at this workplace, that their livelihoods are bound up in the workplace. That's a very dangerous attitude because workplaces can close down tomorrow. You know, you have to be fighting for the union for go beyond one workplace. Can't have socialism in one workplace. Can't have a decent union in one workplace. In one, you know, I'm riffing on Trotsky's thing. You can't have socialism in one country. Mm-hmm. Very, very true. Can't have a good union in one workplace. So, but no, a lot of unions will say, no, everything depends on us appeasing the company. So they'll go into negotiations already on a defensive posture, already giving things away, even before the company asks, you know? And that's just you're going to whittle down your benefits to nothing. And then people are going to be like, why bother being in a union? You know, my pay is low, my benefits suck, I'm paying union dues, why? I don't agree with that. I still, it's better to be in a union than not to be in a union. But you can see where the thinking comes from, that I'm not getting enough from this, you know, and doesn't feel like mine, you know. I was reading a thing today from an ILWU, International Longshoremen Workers Union activist, who I think I actually met this person once, but anyway, they were talking about the necessity of union meetings, that they're lucky to be in a union that still has, you know, union meetings for the members, and that's where they can decide union policy and so on. A lot of unions have done away with their union meetings, or some have, including mine, unfortunately, any real union meetings. And
this is where the educational part comes in.
That could be part of it, yeah.
To have everybody
right.
in a meeting.
Right, exchanging and ideas
and
viewpoints.
And having their inputs of your other, you know,
yeah.
constituents,
yeah.
so to speak.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's a big part of the education. Hey, by the way, we got to give our legal ID here. We're WMFO Medford, WMFO in Medford. And this is Socialist Radio, and you are listening to 91.5 FM WMFO Medford, Tufts Free Form Radio. We're talking music from a working class, democratic socialist perspective here on Socialist Radio. We're here every other Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And if you tune into WMFO anytime, you can go to WMFO.org, listen with your computer. You can, if you're close enough to the station, go to 91.5 FM over the air. Hits parts of Medford, Somerville, Tufts University, where we emanate from. We're also known as Tufts Educational Radio. And anyway, let's continue with this article, quite good, Work Ethic Under Socialism. Now, socialists propose to completely change the nature of work in a truly democratic social society. No longer would anyone be allowed to make a profit without lifting a finger themselves, and to use their wealth and power to set the terms and conditions of everybody else's workday. Instead, people would come together democratically to decide what kind of society they want to see, what needs should be met, what problems ought to be solved, and work backward from that to identify what kind of work needs to be done to make our collective dreams a reality. This society would then empower democratically accountable planning agencies to figure out how to go about training and attracting people to these jobs. Once hired, workers would have the ability to make decisions collectively about how companies operate, or whatever you would call them. They wouldn't necessarily be called companies then.
Unemployment would go down.
There would be no unemployment. It doesn't have to be.
Yeah.
Including how much they internally compensate for what type of work.
What was that figure? The Soviet Union had unemployment at one point.
Right. Yeah.
Versus America.
I don't think they had any unemployment while they were doing a sort of planned economy, but it was a bureaucratically planned economy, mm-hmm. a Stalinist planned economy. We're talking about here a democratically planned economy. One thing that you just reminded me of, kind of off a little bit off topic, but I just want to say it real quick. Do you realize that in the United States there was a full employment bill passed in the Congress?
I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Of course, they don't tell us. I forget
the time. It was either the 60s or the late 40s. I have to double check. But, full employment bill. And the reason I mention is because it's progressive populism, left populism, is nothing new in the United States. People that claim to be socialist and don't understand that, you're not really getting what socialism is about. Historical materialism is part of the theoretical analytical weapons of socialism. Look back and see how the sky was promised, even in America, to workers, to the point where they passed a full employment bill. They just didn't fund it.
That's why I didn't know about it.
They got the
I didn't even know that existed.
They got the votes. They probably cut off a movement at the time that was fighting for it, and then just didn't fund it. Didn't
and this happened didn't when? In the 40s?
I have to check that. I think it's 1948, but it could be a little
McCarthyism,
farther.
McCarthyism, the Cold War came in, and
it could have even been the 60s. But what were the times of when the Democrats decided they had to do a left populist Keynesian type thing rather than austerity measures, rather than neoliberalism, you know, naked capitalism, so to speak? Well, they did that in the 30s under Roosevelt, obviously. They did it even going into the 40s, even in the late 40s, under Truman to a certain extent, although there was a beginnings of a backlash, Taft-Hartley Act and other stuff like that. Then in the 50s, the capitalists in the United States were so afraid of the labor movement that gains were made, even though unions started to decline a little bit in membership and struggles were still a lot of strikes, but they were even less than... They were less and less potent, less what's the word I'm looking for? Less significant in some ways than in the 30s. Although there was a general strike in Oakland in 1946 and so on, what I'm trying to say is that in the 50s, it kind of became down, you know, like the rules were kind of understood to a certain extent. You know, unions are very powerful. If we put up a picket line, it means something. The boss said, yeah, yeah, it means something. It means something. By the early 70s, even the late 60s, bosses were like, big corporations were like, nah, doesn't mean that much to us anymore. And we can make even more profits than we made in the post-Trump strike, which was by that at that time a record level of profits. And that record lasted for a long time, might still exist. They were making huge profits, but they wanted more. And they consciously got together in the early 70s, Business Roundtable and other corporate organizations, and they tried to figure out how to go back and on the offensive against labor, basically. And they were both helped and hurt by the big recession in 74, 75. That was like a big thing that the corporations, it hurt some of their profit levels. But they also used it as an excuse to start clamping down.
Yep.
In the 70s, you had the Carter administration, huge, and all those people saying what a nice guy Jimmy Carter was. Jimmy Carter was scum, is scum, always will be scum, because he attacked the labor movement viciously. Through deregulation with the Kennedys and the Tsongases and all those other idiots, they did the Democratic Party idiots. They did the major deregulation, destroyed the Teamsters Union over the.
So it's safe to say the Democrats did more damage to the Labor Party, the labor movement, or labor, and than the Republicans.
And that was a
historically.
No, I wouldn't say. I wouldn't go that far because it depends. Again, I'm talking about. That's a good point because I should have said this is another round of a type of progressive populism. In terms of rhetoric under the Carter administration, right? Although the cuts were really starting to happen,
mm-hmm.
They were the rhetoric was, "Oh, you have a Democrat now, and it's you know it's no longer Nixon, and things are you know we're going to do things better." And actually, no. But that's why Carter lost. One reason Carter lost was because people were like, "This is not good." Reagan gets in. That's certainly not Democratic Party progressivism. But you had like even under Nixon, this is a thing that sounds like a contradiction, but you have to follow the logic. There was a mass movement. That mass movement forced even the conservative Nixon regime to make concessions that Carter didn't even come close to. Carter didn't even make concessions like that. So it's when people say, "Yeah, you have to have the Democrats in or nothing." Well, wait a minute. You look back at the Nixon administration, and it passed more progressive legislation than a lot of other, practically almost any other regime you can think of, because of the pressure of the mass movement. Even though it was Republican, conservative Republican. Now the same thing happened under FDR with a liberal Democrat. The mass movement forced the FDR's hand. It was not. And he used to talk about it. He'd say, "I don't know why some of the right wingers are against me because I'm saving capitalism for them." And he knew exactly what he was doing, giving temporary concessions in order to placate a huge mass movement and a huge upswing in the labor movement in most of the 30s after 1933. What I'm trying to say is that during these periods where the Democratic Party or even the Republican Party in certain examples like Eisenhower a little bit, Nixon a little bit, they'll pull out some progressive reforms and progressive rhetoric in order to get people to vote for them, to keep engaged in not starting a new party and all that kind of thing. And so it's nothing new. And so that's where this full employment thing comes from. Yeah, they passed the full employment legislation and they didn't fund it and it meant nothing, but it got a lot of votes at the time and it destroyed a movement because the graveyard of mass movements is the Democratic Party. You know, I mean, it's, look at, again, we'll mention Sanders just because there's so many illusions in Sanders among lefties, some lefties, that he talks the talk about you need a mass movement to get some of the things he's talking about, but he doesn't go out and organize one. Because Democrats don't do that. Democratic Party politicians don't organize mass movements. Their answer is vote for me, give money to my campaign, lobby, help other Democrats get elected, and help us lobby, you know, to get certain legislation passed in the legislature. And that's going to be your ticket out. That's going to solve things for you. No, it's not. Because your political party is not mine. It's a corporate political party. Because that's not how things have happened historically. They happen from mass movements, if they happen at all. And then they get screwed around with it. I mean, I'm not saying that it's a good system that requires huge mass movements to get any little thing passed, you know? Because, like, look at under Nixon, Roe versus Wade gets passed, so abortion rights get passed. But it's been problematic in many states to get access to, you know, reproductive rights, the reproductive services, you know? So Democrat, or it's a $15 an hour minimum wage thing, right? There's states where the movement was big, or cities, then the minute Democrats get their hands on it, they elongate it. They say, oh, well, phase in over, let's say, 5 or 6 years or whatever. That doesn't help. That keeps us below the rate of the real rate of inflation.
And so by then, that $15 might as well just be $10 because things go up.
Yep, exactly.
You know, rent.
Yep, everything.
Food. You were talking off air
education,
about how much do you spend a week on food?
It's hard to get a clear figure because,
and this is not going to whole checks.
Yeah, this is going to Market Basket,
and
a little bit,
casket.
Yeah, a little bit Trader Joe's, but I'd say it's like $200 a week minimum, or more, and trying to be cheap about it and failing because I don't know. It's just, especially if you buy protein, man. You know, I mean, it's just a lot of money. It's a lot of money, even the places that are supposedly cheap. I know some people that go to Aldi's. Do you ever hear of Aldi's?
That's that German conglomerate.
I don't know what it is. Yeah. It's the same ones that own Trader Joe's, but I don't know if it's German or what, but I don't know. Out in Worcester, they got like an Aldi somewhere. I don't know if they have any around here. And it's the grossest little store. My father used to like them. Because you go in, and you can't recognize a brand. The brand names are all weird. Like, you don't notice it. There's no brand that you actually will recognize in an Aldi's. It's like they get all the overstock or something from these weird brands.
Uh-huh.
And it's mostly canned. My memory of all these is mostly canned food. Really gross. Really cheap. Like, the stores tend to be small. Not much selection. Not hardly any fresh food. You know, there's some frozen stuff.
It's all canned.
It's all garbage. Foods. It's almost free. To use a generalization, that you can find some exceptions, I guess. But my feeling was it was all garbage. Back when my father would drag me there, you had to pay a quarter to get a shopping cart out, and you get your quarter back when you return
it. Make sure
it.
Yeah, they do that in Europe.
You do box.
You put the euro in, and then, okay, I get my euro back. But they think I'm going to steal the cart?
Yeah. they don't have bags. They put your stuff in boxes. It's just like...
Like a BJ's.
And there's hardly anyone around. Like, there's like one or two workers in the store. Like, the one me and my father went to. The one he dragged me to. I hated it. And at the end of the day, suppose you save some money from all that. But you know how unhealthy it is to just eat out of a can and stuff that you can't
recognize? All that recognize? Processed stuff.
Yeah,
instead of you making it fresh, you know how you made it, how you it.
Yeah, anyway. Continuing this article, The Work Ethic Under Socialism by Megan Day. Just to finish up. Socialists propose to completely change the nature of work. In a truly democratic social society, no longer would anyone be allowed to make a profit. Oh, I already read that part. Sorry. Society would empower... Okay, hold on. Of course, there will be work under socialism, though surely less of it. And we want people to feel motivated to perform it and take pride in it, rather than guilting workers into breaking their backs for someone else's profit and then castigating them for not finding that particularly fulfilling. We should endeavor to deliberately create an economic and political system that motivates workers by empowering them as decision makers, both in the civic sphere and in the workplace. So she's using a lot of language that I think could be simpler and better understood. But anyway, our goal should be to foster a whole new type of work ethic, one that doesn't just translate to grit and bear it stamina, but instead to a hunger for active participation and avenues to exercise agency. Meaning, I'm going to rephrase that one. And ways to be part of deciding what kind of work is going to be done and needs to be done in society, how to use the resources of society. Because this would include, you know, if we had truly democratic planning in the economy, it would include how do we use natural resources? You know, how much of the Amazon rainforest are we going to use? I think hopefully the answer would be zero because it's already been used quite a bit.
Yeah.
You know, we find other ways to do that.
How are we going to reforest our lands?
I think one of the first things...
Did you hear about Ethiopia? They did a big program. They started putting trees.
Yes,
thousands.
I did read about that,
to offset the... desertification. Global warming.
Yeah, also desert... Yeah.
I said, that's... Wow, this is Ethiopia. Yeah. Not one of the most progressive places, but they're doing something.
No, I'm fascinated by that stuff of reforestation and desert... How to stop deserts from spreading.
Mm-hmm.
And there are ways to do it. It's just very labor-intensive, but there's ways to do it. In parts of Africa... Parts of Iceland, they're doing that successfully. Part of the thing is, just to riff on it for a second, part of the thing is you have to have some diversity. You don't just plant like a row of trees and that's it. Yeah. You gotta build windbreaks. You gotta build. You gotta have other smaller shrubs and stuff like that.
Ecosystems.
You have to think of the water supply. You have to think of a lot of different things. It's fascinating stuff, though. But again,
and it can be done under socialism.
It will be done much better under socialism because even a place, even a economy like Iceland's, which is pretty rich by world standards, they're pretty slow about the whole thing. The reforestation. They've got technologies in Iceland that are really interesting because they have the hot springs, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So they can use...
they're growing bananas, I heard.
I'm looking for the right word, the hot air and water, to put it simply, for power, which a lot of places can't. So they're primed to have actually to be a very, very rich country. They're still kind of lagging. Because it's capitalism, you know? You gotta invest in all. Like they're building, you talk about bananas, right? Yeah, they build, I actually researched this. They build greenhouses in Iceland.
Because of that heat and, from that water.
Powers the whole thing.
That's why it's like when I went to the Azores, what? From where?
Yeah.
Bananas? From where? You would think Angola.
Yeah.
Or somewhere in Africa, Mozambique. No, it's just from Iceland.
Well, it's that example I gave.
Like, all right, I give up.
It's that example.
How did that even happen? But
yeah. Well, we talked about this on the air one time. I don't know, I think this figure is still accurate. What is the second largest exporter of agricultural goods of countries in the world today? And if it's wrong, it's only wrong by a few years. Yeah, everyone thinks of China. Well, that's a good guess, but that's not the case.
Iceland.
The Netherlands.
Oh, the Netherlands.
Netherlands is number two. I forget who number one is. It might be China. Netherlands. The Netherlands. I've been there many times. It's a tiny country.
Netherlands, what? Norway, Sweden?
No, the Netherlands is just the Netherlands. Dutch.
Oh, the Netherlands.
Holland,
oh, okay.
Holland. It's Holland.
Oh, okay, okay.
Technically, the Netherlands is not even, so in the eastern part of Belgium, they speak Flemish, which is very close to, basically, it's the language of the Netherlands. But not even counting that, just the Netherlands, you know, that little, those, you know, where all the dikes are put up, the dams and stuff. To
Amsterdam,
stop.
All yeah. those places, Rotterdam.
How could that be the second largest exporter of agricultural products in the world? Well,
greenhouses,
yeah. And a large investment in greenhouse technology and so on, even under capitalism, although I'm sure they've been subsidized by the government. And it works, the stuff works really well. It works really, really well. And you can
have you ever been there?
Power them. I've been there many times, yeah. Well, I don't know, as many, what should I say? I've been there three times. For me, that's many.
Me too, three times.
Three times, yeah. And
I went 97, 2000, and then every 3 years I was doing this. I was like, let me save up money and then go.
Me too.
I loved it.
Can't do that anymore, though.
I was like, oh my God. What a different culture. What, you know, the bike system, interacting with the...
Yeah.
I was like, if I knew Dutch and, you know, marry one of these girls, you know, I'm all set.
Yeah, no, it's very different.
Uncle Sam, bye-bye. Yeah.
It's not paradise or anything because, like, I had a very unique opportunity there. Instead of just being a tourist, I stayed with a Dutch guy that lived right in Amsterdam in what they called social housing. I forget what the Dutch word for it was. And he was fighting to preserve it because it was being gentrified. And I don't know where he ended up with that. I'm still on Facebook friends with him, so I should ask him straight out what happened with that fight. So I spent some of my time...
And I assume he's a socialist, like...
He was more of a liberal, but I think he's become a socialist, based partially on that. He had a good friend he introduced me to who was a public school teacher who was a definite socialist. And that guy actually let me speak to his class. I spoke to two different classes in a high school in the Netherlands, mostly immigrant youth. Mm-hmm. And I was I just gave him the socialist thing, you know. And he also got me on a cable TV show.
Wow.
But the cable TV guy was hilarious because he was very anti-socialist. He had been like one of these active in the 60s types that got turned off, the Big Chill types, you know, that became
used to be radical, and then he's like, this
is within the 90s, you know. And there was that time period in the 90s where there was a boom in the U.S. economy, short one, the tech boom, the dot-com, the tech boom, exactly, towards the end of the 90s. That's when I was there. So he was going on about, and I think I was there in early 2001, I think I was there. But anyway, he was still riffing off of that. I was talking about homelessness in California and stuff like that. He's like, well, what are you talking about homelessness? I knew someone that bought property. That, you know, he's like, you're giving me these like, personal anecdotes about rich people and stuff. And I'm like, well, that's very good for them in a way, but bad for us. And getting into arguments with him on the which was interesting, on the cable TV show. The kids in the high school...
Not a bad, like more of a debated...
No, no, he was a jerk. He was nasty.
Oh, okay.
But it probably was interesting in a way. It's hard to get a ride. The Dutch people were pretty laid back, so this guy was getting angry, which I liked. I like pushing his buttons. He was getting angry on the air, yeah. I want him to lose it, man. Are you kidding? This guy was the enemy. You know, he's a propagandist for capitalism. So I wanted him to lose it. He almost did. He got angry. And my friend was really who knew this guy was like mortified.
Yeah, he's like, oat, oat.
Now my friend was like mortified. He wanted everyone to get along, and I'm like, it's not gonna happen. But the thing. What was I gonna say? The story about the social school. Housing, yep. the rallies I went to there. I mean there was struggle. There's class struggle in the Netherlands, but. You got to understand, it's one of the oldest capitalist countries in the world. It was the country that had the first corporation. The East India Corporation was based in Amsterdam.
Yeah, wasn't the Dutch? Didn't they have New York at one point?
And they had the whole colonial empire and all that. Yeah. So they,
a lot of the places I've noticed where you're from in New York, they got Dutch names. Yeah, yeah. You know?
Weird ones too. Weird Dutch names, like
Plattsburgh.
Yeah, well, that might be Dutch. Yeah, that's a good example. Also, there's this, the Dutch word for stream is kill, K-I-L-L.
Street?
So, stream.
Oh, stream.
So you'd have, there's a lot of streams that have the word kill at the end, and you're kind of like, And even where I grew up, like right around where I grew up, and you'd be like, oh, that's the blah, blah kill, or the blah, blah kill. Oh, interesting. You know? Or they'd have Mohawk Indian names, which are pretty cool, too. Yeah, but anyway, the point is that... you know, the school that I spoke at was supposedly one of the roughest neighborhoods in Amsterdam. Now, at the time, it was not that rough. Compared to the U.S. public housing and stuff like that, it was much better. However, since then, I think this existed in some other places, but the drug thing in Amsterdam is pretty bad. You know, like all the stuff about
opioids.
How nice we can smoke pot. Oh, okay, fine. I don't care. But there's an underside to the drug trade there, you know, just like anywhere else. So they've got problems there, you know. Probably when, you know, they're going to hit hard by a big recession like a lot of other big capitalist countries, you know. The capitalists there have been clawing back a lot of the... reforms that people had won. There was a big left and this guy was showing me around. The guy I was staying with would take me like this park. There'd be a statue of like a communist leader from the resistance or whatever. I went to the big best. One of the best things I did there was he took me to with this other guy who was a socialist. Took me to the small museum of Dutch resistance during World War II. Brilliant, brilliant museum and real heroes. People that really sacrificed everything to fight the Nazis in a society that was. Somewhat complacent towards it initially, you know, like the Nazis come rolling in. Oh, there's some people with blonde hair and all that. You know, this is just our natural taking over Europe. You know, and some of the Dutch went a lot like you know the famous wasn't it Quisling? Was that the Dutch mm-hmm. leader that went along with it?
Well, they already had Nazi type parties there,
yeah,
stuff and once
like
they
that,
came
yeah,
in, oh, yeah, yeah. oh, welcome,
yeah.
You know,
and that changed.
That's like that movie Flame and Citron kind of illustrates that.
Yeah, yeah.
Those two guys that really were a headache to the Nazis.
Yeah. So there was some really good. That was a brilliant museum. Anyway, the point is that if I'd stayed there longer, this is all from like a 1 week or week and a half there. If I'd stayed there longer, I would have probably. Ended up in jail. Probably would have found some really important struggle to get involved in. It would have been like,
well, at least it's a Dutch
he's a foreigner.
Jail. It's nicer than
yeah.
the U.S.
It will be nicer. It will be nicer. Yeah, yeah. But it was. You know, the thing about Europe that people, and again, this is changing right under our nose, and has changed in some places for like in Britain for really bad. But what I discovered when I was younger and traveling in Europe, and when I lived in France for a short time. I'm sorry, man. Everyday life for working people is better. It's just better. by the numbers. And of course, there are exceptions.
In
a lot of those countries, a lot of the countries, not Britain so much, but now. I've been to Britain since that time, and it's definitely gotten a lot worse. Yeah. But and of course, every country's like that. France is a lot worse now than when I was there, in terms of and Macron and the attacks on the pension is part of all that. It's just everyday life working people is better. And I just was racking my brain trying to figure out a way to stay there. I felt the pull back here of like relationships and politics back here, because they are influenced by U.S. imperialism and U.S. capitalism. Mm-hmm. They're very much, you'll be in a nice old European city and there'll be a stupid McDonald's or something. And
oh, I hate that.
Yeah. Or it's like, or even
stop following
less, or even less, less obvious. You'll find out that car is actually owned by Ford. It was produced by Ford or GM or whatever. And, for a while, I think Volvo was owned by Ford for a while, or maybe still is. I don't know. But all the things people think about Scandinavia and all that stuff is constantly changing. And you have to be a Marxist to really understand that. Dialectical materialism, constant change. What are the processes at work with their contradictions and all of having a high level of social benefits, but relatively speaking, it decreasing. So for the people that live there, things are seem serious, that to us, what are you complaining about? You still have free education, free healthcare, like that. They say, well, if you really start talking to them, you'll find out it used to be freer, not that long ago. And some of them still remember the old days where it wasn't at all, where it was really, really bad. I mean, remember that we used to talk about this. We talked about this on the air one time. There was a film called, it starred that guy, that Swedish actor that's in a lot of stuff. Who's the tall guy? He's still alive, amazingly. Max von Sydow, I think is his name. Mm-hmm. So Max von Sydow was in a film, and I can't remember the name of it, about Swedish immigrant workers living in Norway in the 30s and how absolutely horrible their conditions were.
I never seen
that. And that people were starting to organize and stuff, So it's like, Scandinavia, capitalism, you either get the stupid idea that it's socialism, which is not, because capitalists still control the economy, or you get the idea that this is how capitalism could work, and ignoring the history of class struggle there, the history of almost revolution under capitalism, and that people fought and got to that point, and it didn't just happen, the benefits didn't just happen, and they won't just stay there either. But anyway, to finish off this article on the work ethic here. Our goal should be, new type of work ethic. Under democratic socialism, workers would not only be able to explain how their work contributes to society, but also endeavor to make change if they find the rationales insufficient. Pathways that are completely blocked for most workers today, meaning you don't get to even have that conversation, much less decision about work. Considerations about people's relationship to work need not turn people off socialism. On the contrary, they ought to excite people about socialism's potential. Under capitalism, too many people are simply biding their time, watching the clock, working for the weekend. We can have a new type of society, one in which people work not just to survive while the bosses live in luxury, but in which we work to meet our collective needs instead and find much greater fulfillment in the process. So I thought that was a really good article. And we often, even on this show where we like to explain basic stuff, we often take for granted some, knowledge of socialism, ideas of what our goals are. It's good to go back, I think, and talk about that. So we're running out of time, but we'll do a little bit of this 2020 stuff. It's an article from socialistworld.net, a very good article. 2020 promises to start as 2019 ended with global protests and capitalist instability. And, the holidays kind of make me nervous sometimes because it's hard to do politics during the holidays, mm-hmm. But I like the holidays too. I like the rest. I like the not being at work if I have time off.
Family time.
Family, yeah. We saw the Star Wars movie yesterday, for example.
Don't tell me. My cousin always types like, no, I want to. Did it suck?
No, it didn't suck.
Okay.
It didn't suck. Everyone's jumping on the it sucked bandwagon, but it didn't suck.
Because it's Disney.
Yeah, it's okay.
It's not Lucas.
It's okay. Lucas sucked.
I mean, they messed up on The Last Jedi. That when I seen that movie, I was like, "What? Thank God I didn't spend money for this because I got it at the library."
Yeah. Well, I think Lucas sucked too, but we'll leave that on hold for now. Our film discussion. So this is from
Avatar 2 is coming out. You hear about that?
The what?
Avatar 2 is coming out.
When?
I don't know, but it's in the process.
Well,
next year.
Well, how long have we been hearing that?
No, it's in a process. I think you can actually look up the trailer.
But I've been hearing that for a long time. That just that it's in the process.
It's either coming out.
You're saying it's
already
closer.
Done. Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, that's great news.
It's basically done. It's
just, I liked Avatar. Liked it a lot.
So I wonder how this is going to play out. How this one's going to be.
Well, I heard it was going to be a prequel, as they say, before the time frame of the earlier film. But I liked it a lot. But when I saw their plan for waiting so long for the sequel to come out, I thought that was a mistake.
That was like 10 years ago,
wasn't
it?
Was a mistake. It was a while ago. No, I don't think it was 10. But really? That long ago?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. No.
I remember.
Really?
I was still employed at Rite Aid. This is before I got fired.
Yep. Wow.
Yeah, so it was 2009.
Wow.
10 years ago.
That's amazing. But
it goes like that, because you feel like it was just yesterday.
Well, when they first started to publish that they were going to make
that theater
sequels.
On Church Street was still open.
Yeah.
In Harvard.
Yeah.
Now it's vacant.
Yeah.
And it's still, I was like, why don't you just reopen it?
Thank you, capitalism, by the way. I used to love that theater. When I first blew into town, that theater show was what was called at the time a repertory theater, and then it showed, it would take two movies, maybe three, and show them over and over again from noon to midnight. That was
nice. You could be there all day just having
exactly. You buy one ticket and you can be there all day and see three movies and see movies over and over again. And at that time in the 80s,
they didn't catch on
home,
to it.
Home, no, that was what they did. That's how they made their money. That was their shtick, you know. That's how they made money. Probably when someone hears that, they think, well, homeless people will be camped out all day. There was less homelessness then. So there were few. But it wasn't.
This is the 90s.
80s.
80s.
Yeah, okay. Early 80s. But it was great for serious film people, you know. And they wouldn't show just first run. They would show second run and stuff like that. And then you had another theater in Harvard Square that showed foreign films. The Brattle showed foreign films.
Yep.
At one point, three theaters in the square, all within walking distance. So I remember one of them had a... there's a Harvard Film Archive, but that's kind of quirky, but... They had one of the theaters had a Ingmar Bergman retrospective. They showed like 90% of his films or something like that. It was amazing. And this is a commercial theater doing this, but independent. But you know, and I'm like, oh my God, I just couldn't believe it. Because he got nothing like that where I grew up, you know, nothing like that. In fact, the only reason I ever saw foreign films when I grew up was because I had a film teacher, believe it or not, in high school who... was on the side a film critic. He decided to create a course which they let him create in high school for seniors as an elective
on films.
To watch foreign films.
Wow.
And some of them he would get shown in the high school theater outside of our class, but that was a little rarer. And all of a sudden, so that was just blew my mind. Just opened up worlds, you know. And I never got along with the guy though. He just tried to be really hip, you know, and I was kind of nerdy or whatever. And he was like, and I was a, this is a sound like contradiction, I was a bit of a jock too, so I was like a nerdy jock or something. And so we never got along. He liked to orientate to the tough kids. He liked to swear and stuff, you know? But he knew I liked that stuff. He never said anything till like towards the end of the year. He's like, would you mind writing something about how this class is valuable to you? I'm like, yeah, I love this class. I don't like you. I didn't say that to him. But I mean, like, I don't like you, jerk, but I like this class a lot, you know. And I wrote this thing, and he's like, great, yeah, boom, you know. And then I come here, right? Wow, Ingmar Bergman retrospective in a commercial theater. Of course, those days are gone now.
So you never go to New York City, how do you compare New York City to Boston?
I don't know enough about New York. I used to go there in the 90s and find some really cool stuff, you know. But I think it's changed a lot. Like one of the theaters I went to there, about four. I checked in with a friend of mine who lived in New York. I said, "Whatever happened to that theater?" They're like, "It's gone. It's gone, man." But New York was fun because like you could go out at 11, and you know we'd plan to go to the movies at 11 at night. Like the film would start at 11.
Mm-hmm.
You get out like around 1, and you go eat.
Leisure time here.
What's the big movie theater chain like that? That's still like the one downtown. What's that called?
Regal.
Again? No, the other one.
AMX.
No, the other one. AMC.
AMC.
Is there another one?
AMC.
No, that's it. Okay.
Paramount.
Probably AMC. So this was an AMC theater in the village somewhere in Manhattan, and or maybe not in the village. Maybe it was up towards NYU or is it NYU in the village? Yeah, it was. Anyway, see, I don't know New York anymore. I used to know a little bit. Anyway, so we go to this theater, then we go to a restaurant called Round the Clock or something like that. Good, like, food. Not like fancy, but just like good food, solid food. Get home around 3, you know, go to sleep. Whatever. You know, you go to a bar if you want to. We didn't
and
hang out in bars.
The subway's still going.
The subway's still going. Bars are still open. I mean, yeah. People are out. I mean, really out. Like, lots of people. But I don't know what it's like now. I don't know what it's like now. It's all gentrified. Maybe they want it quiet.
No, same thing. I went there on Thanksgiving. The Thanksgiving.
This year?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah? What's it like?
I was there all. It's same. You know, it's never sleeps.
Good. I like that.
I was eating Chinese at 2 in the morning and, yeah. Over by Washington Heights.
Yep. Yep. I like that. Yeah, no.
Subways are going. Just watch out. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Keep your eye on.
I had a moment in my life where someone I was going out with, a girlfriend of mine, felt like she had to move to New York. Actually, were we living together here? No, we weren't living together, but we had separate apartments. We were together a lot. So she goes, I have to go to New York. I don't like it here, blah, blah, blah. And she said, come to New York with me. So I would have had to drop my job, the union work I was doing, the political work I was doing. And I just was really scared about what I would do for if I could get a job or not there, you know?
Yeah, more expensive.
Yeah, exactly.
New York
so,
City.
Yeah. And so I just, I said, no, we tried to do the long distance thing. It didn't work out. Could have ended up there. And when she was there, it didn't happen right away. We still went out for like a year or two when she was there. I would go there and spend like two weeks at a time there sometimes. Great. Had a great time. Money would run out. Money would run out. That is true. But, you know, it's funny because in New York, as long as you got a roof over your head, there's no guarantee of that. You can at least walk around, you know? I mean, even without much money, you can just walk around. Pizza's cheap. Good. Like I try to tell my kids what real pizza is. They don't understand. Stuff around here, this pan pizza.
No, you got to go to North real. End for the real stuff.
Yeah, I guess. I don't even know where to get it there.
Regina.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So anyway, 2020, we're going to have to end with this probably. 2020, promises to start as 2019 ended with global protests and capitalist instability from socialistworld.net. And this is a good article about it. It's from December 23rd. Good stuff about the what's happened in London recently in Europe recently with the election. If you look at some of the stats, Labour actually under Corbyn and a more left wing leadership actually did better than the more conservative Labour people did. Listen to this. A lot of people, you'll never see this in the U.S. press, for example. Johnson won, Boris Johnson, who's the equivalent of Trump, won by raising the Tory vote a measly 1.2% because Labour lost 7.9% of its support. But this 32.2% share that the Labour Party got under Corbyn in this recent election was still higher than Gordon Brown's 29%, Brown was Labour, in 2010, and Ed Miliband's 30% in 2015. So this is not the first sort of crisis of Labour being beat by the Tories, unfortunately. But those other two were kind of right-wing Labour, and Corbyn was left-wing Labour. So make no mistake about it. We're not talking about Labour Party is like the Democratic Party. They're very different even today. Labour Party has official union affiliations. It has membership. In fact, the reason that the left came back on the Labour Party was because this guy Miliband that lost by 30% in an election back in 2015. I can't remember if it was while he was running or afterwards, but they had the idea when he was the leader of the Labour Party to open it up for membership so you could pay £3 and join the Labour Party. Here you don't join the Democratic Party. There's nothing to join. You just say, I'm registered to vote as a Democrat. Why you do that, I don't even know, because you can go vote however you want. It empowers the... I think the reason they keep that going is it empowers the two-party system. Say, I try to get some loyalty as a Democratic Party voter or whatever, even though you don't have to vote that way. So anyway, And also, the article goes into, the Brexit thing, but also stuff that the U.S. population didn't hear too much about, that there was a huge, these accusations of anti-Semitism against left-wing of Labour, which is not true at all. There were examples of red-baiting, good old, anti-communist witch hunt type stuff thrown at Corbyn. And also there was right populism, where Johnson, who will do everything he can to destroy the National Health Service, actually promised to put money into it. Well, and I probably will put money into it, but even the conservatives, because in a lot of those countries that have national health care, even the conservatives are afraid to directly attack it.
To Trump when he said, I would support, what was that thing that we supported?
Well, there's a lot of names for it. Medicare for All is the current one, but single payer, universal health care, all that. Well, what Trump said was that he wouldn't get rid of the Obamacare, but he would parts of it.
He said he would consider the single health care.
Oh, really? I never heard that. Okay.
In the beginning, when he first got in.
Yep.
Kind of like what he's doing. I'll put money into it, even though he wants to destroy it.
Yep. The other thing that maybe got a little bit of press here about the British elections was the fact that there was a right wing in the Labour Party that did everything it could to sabotage the elections. Like, if you looked at, Labour had a very progressive manifesto, much more to the left than like what Sanders is talking about and all that, and like renationalized the rail companies, stuff like that. And the right wingers wouldn't go out and campaign on that. They campaigned on crap, like their own personalities or Boris Johnson's bad or whatever, and they lost. They lost a lot of the right wingers. A lot of the Labour defeats were right wingers getting defeated that still existed in the party. But that's kind of Corbyn's fault for not going after them, getting them out of the party sooner or at all, basically. But the point of the article is that none of the problems facing Britain, and there are many, are going to be solved under Johnson's and the Tories, and there's going to be a huge struggle, especially since now people feel blocked at the electoral level. Like, there were a lot of illusions in Labour getting in power, which would have been problems with Corbyn in power, because he was, like, for example, another thing people don't know about is that Labour was doing these big rallies like about a year ago. As it got closer to the election, they pulled back on them. So Corbyn was trying to appease the right wing of the Labour Party. So if he was in power, he'd probably do the same thing. Just like if Sanders wins the primary of the Democratic Party, it's going to be even worse. And I'll make an analogy here, because if someone like Corbyn gets elected, there's at least a party behind him, a Labour Party that's not controlled by the capitalists, although it's influenced by them, it's not controlled by them. The Democratic Party is run by capitalists, pro-capitalists. So if Sanders got in, right, he would, from day one, be sliding to the right, under the pressure of that. And he's got no party behind him, no movement behind him. Voters are not a movement. That's a thing that Sanders and others, even some people on the left, they call the Sanders thing a movement. It's not a movement. They created Our Revolution. Sanders created Our Revolution after the last election, but he didn't make it a membership party, membership group. It's just a lobbying.
And he's got to be independent.
Just a lobbying front
to begin with.
Yeah, yeah. No, he's, that's what I'm getting at. Yeah.
Didn't he, after he lost, he was interviewed by Amy Goodman on Democracy Now, and it said right there, independent socialist, instead of Democrat.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's still... That's
so
still,
right there, you're contradicting
battling people on Facebook about that.
Yeah.
Some guy...
So he's interviewed with this title saying independent socialist.
Some guy wrote on Facebook yesterday, commenting on something I wrote, said, I don't know, Sanders isn't a Democrat. And I wrote back saying, well, Sanders registered as a Democrat to run in the last election. He's done the same thing for this election. So he's actually registered as a Democrat. Mm-hmm. Secondly, the reality of it is, even when he was an independent, he was a Democrat after a certain point. Starting in 1984, he supported Mondale. Then in the early 90s, he went to the Harvard Kennedy School, and he made a deal with them, with the Democratic Party leadership. The Democratic Party said, the deal was, don't run anyone against me being Sanders, in Vermont, and I will support your national presidential candidates in Vermont. And other Democrats, I will actually, campaign for them. That's what he did, very, very loyally, ever since 1992, I think it was. And as a result, he got committee assignments. He would block vote with the Democrats. He'd get committee assignments from the Democrats. Howard Dean, ex-governor of Vermont, who ran for president, said in the last election cycle, 2015 or whatever that was, 2016, that Sanders voted 99% of the time with the Democratic Party. He voted more Democratic Party than a lot of Democrats. So, also, Sanders was known as a consummate fundraiser for the Senate Democrats. Once he became a senator, he would go around to rich people like Abby Rockefeller, so I don't get a lot of money for the party, for the Senate Democrats. Prior to, I don't know if that continued after 2016, because remember in the 2016 he said, "Oh, I'm not going to take any corporate donations." Depending how you define that, he pretty much kept to that, more or less. So I don't know if he goes out and, I know he goes out and campaigns for other Democrats. Remember the Unity tour after he endorsed Clinton? So he endorsed Clinton, campaigned for Clinton, but then also campaigned for others, and still doing that. Anyway, so you're still going to see Britain in, you're going to see a lot of struggles in Britain, most likely. In fact, move on to global protests that had people might or may not be aware of that are listening here. But Chile had a big protest. Iraq, Iran,
China,
Hong Kong, etc. So this article goes into Latin America. Engulfed in a wave of revolution press from Chile and Bolivia to Ecuador, Argentina, and Brazil. I hadn't read much about the Argentinian ones. Chile's been the most successful so far.
Also, even Colombia has had
really
a backlash. That's interesting. Against their, what's that guy who's in charge? That right wing.
Horrible. Middle East and Maghreb, meaning Algeria. This is interesting. Algeria, geographically the biggest country in Africa, had overthrown French imperialism through revolution in the 50s and 60s, but has subsequently degenerated at the top into an ossified autocratic clique, capitalist clique. A mass movement, particularly young people, has demonstrated democratic rights and improvements in living standards. A lot of these movements that we've talked about on the show before that are being summarized very quickly here are based on protests against, they call it corruption, and poor living standards. Meaning they're anti-capitalist protests, but they're not using the C word. And that might reflect a low level of consciousness. It might be a real low level of consciousness, but the fact is it's based, it's an anti-capitalist protest, objectively speaking. Magnificent uprising in Iraq, which in the past was mired in sectarian religious division and blighted by terrorism, but now workers are attempting to throw off this legacy in Iraq and reach out for class unity, jobs, and democratic rights. At the end of 2009, more about Iraq in there. I don't have time to go into the details. But except the main thing is being able to get over the religious sectarian things. It's a big step forward for the movement, for the mass movement. And there's a relationship between the mass movement in Iraq and in Iran, in terms of Shia Iran, with which Iraq shares a 900-mile border. Struggles over the last 2 years have shown a rebirth of the workers' organizations in Iran, and now it has experienced the biggest mass movements of opposition and consequently of strike action in response to increases in living costs through rising taxes and price of petrol, of gas. Participation of a new generation of young people has terrified the mullahs who still rule the roost. 200,000 workers and youth in Iran have been involved in demonstrations with an estimated 700 banks torched as outraged workers and youth.
How many banks?
An estimated 700 banks have been torched as outraged workers and youth react to deteriorating living standards. Wow. Now, why can't Americans figure that out?
You know? 700? I got to wrap my head around that number.
There's the big bank. The big bank is making us suffer. Let's make the big bank suffer. This year, Sudan faced similar upheavals as has Lebanon in the biggest movement of opposition to the government in at least 14 years since the previous Cedar Revolution, quote unquote. Consequently, Lebanese flags flew on the skyline and in protest rather than those of sectarian militias. Hong Kong, radicalization of the youth in particular, mass movement. And this article talks about it being a precursor, meaning there's going to be other big upheavals in Asia. Although right now in the U.S. media, corporate media, you only hear about, you know, there's just Hong Kong.
China.
Nothing happening in China.
Nothing in Vietnam. Nothing in the Philippines. Yeah. Nothing in Indonesia.
Hong Kong will have inspired those in Taiwan who are looking for independence, as with the Uyghurs in Xinjiang.
Of course,
they'll
never say Taiwan, right? In the corporate media.
I know. They don't say Taiwan, do they? They're afraid of the Chinese state capitalists. Yeah. Eastern Europe. It's just sort of a check-in there.
Like the Czech Republic or?
Like, well, Hungary, there was some protests. I don't know if they're still going on or not. But they're predicting it will go to other places like Poland, Czech Republic, and so on. Western Europe, Macron, and the French thing, which I wanted to get into today, which we weren't able to. A recent poll in France indicated 89% of the people thought they were living through a social crisis, and 67% felt they thought Macron, the leader of France, what is he, prime minister or president? I think he's prime minister, didn't understand those social difficulties. Macron is considered a president for the rich, basically, in France. So you've already had, at the time of the writing of this, this was written on the 23rd of December, 1 million strong demonstrations embracing all sections of the working class in France, railway workers, air traffic controllers, and many others. And it has spread to other teachers, healthcare workers, and so on. Italy, not aware of big protests, but they're predicting that they could be some. Wait a minute. I'm sorry. In the Sardine movement, or Sardinia, or Sardine? I don't know. Sardine?
Sardinia.
S-A-R-D-I-N-E. I don't know. Islands. Well, tens of thousands of people squashing into squares all over Italy against the Liga and its racist agenda. Oh, yeah, I did see some of those. Future is an anticipation of future movements by Italian workers with their powerful class traditions. Even in Germany, there's social problems emerging. Economic problems, support for the SPD, which was like one of the big, even though it started out as a workers' party, it was more pro-capitalist. That's, they can't rely on that anymore. Finnish prime minister, social democrat, forced to step down because of a postal strike. Basically, instability worldwide. The explosive situation in the U.S. will be crucial for international developments in 2020. Trump has faced a deep-going crisis threatened with impeachment proceedings, although it's far from certain that this will be successful in any trial in the Republican-dominated Senate. The presidential election in 2020 will also be extremely polarized. Remains uncertain who will secure the Democratic Party nomination. Although Sanders has won support, the emergence of Warren and Biden has made it more complicated than 2016. However, growing class polarization within the U.S. will mean developments there will be crucial for the world situation. In 2019, capitalism and those who seek to manage and control the system demonstrated beyond any doubt the incapacity and impossibility of doing this in the interest of the majority throughout the world. Capitalism is now more unequal than ever. One thing is certain, revolts of the peoples around the world will continue as long as the system is allowed to exercise its dominance. The world's tolerance for income inequality and billionaires is declining sharply everywhere, said Alberto Ramos of Goldman Sachs. These understated words indicate looming mass class opposition to capitalism. Because of its failure to come forward with solutions to destructive and terrible climate change, as environmental activist Greta Thunberg has indicated, we've experienced in recent years the hottest decade on record. The Australian, have you been reading about the Australian wildfires? You hear about that?
I always know that Australia is the hottest continent on Earth, isn't it?
I don't know. Only a planned economy, getting back to what we were talking about earlier, can begin to solve the problem, which is only possible on the basis of socialism and democracy. And yet new theoreticians and darlings of capitalism like Branko Milanovic have produced weighty books which seek to convince us that the capitalist system is the sole way forward for humanity. However, as we have demonstrated, this analysis is completely faulty. It's proposed no real lasting solutions. There's an article where they called capitalism the system that ruins the world. They go to a link to capitalism as a system is an absolute barrier to the further progress of humankind. The real alternative to this is socialism, organized on a democratic basis, and 2020 will see big steps forward to realize this goal. So that's pretty optimistic. Yeah, it's optimistic, and I agree with that. You know, look at what's possible in 2020. Hard to predict all the way, but we'll see. We got to go out now. Last words.
Hey, power to the people, and for the new years, or should I say the new decade, keep your head up and your hopes alive.
And we'll do everything we can here at Socialist Radio to, in 2020, to push forward, and outside of Socialist Radio, Socialist Movement in general, to push forward towards socialism. We won't make any grandiose predictions. We're going to achieve democratic socialism in 2020, but we went steps towards that.
It's a process.
Yeah, it's a process. It's a process of building a workers' party, process of, and that means outside of the Republicans and Democrats in this country, process of building an international movement. And we're going to, check us out, and we'll be part of that struggle with you in the new year. And thanks for listening. We'll go out with The Clash and Washington Bullets.
Mama, mama, look there. Your children are playing in the street again. Don't you know what happened down there? A youth of 14 got shot down there.